The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show. I'm Charles Christian, and thank you very much for tuning in again. This week, we travel into the realms of high strangeness in our interview with American author, MUFON investigator and paranormal researcher Preston Dennett. Now, Preston Dennett began investigating UFOs and the paranormal in 1986 when he discovered that his family, friends and co-workers were having dramatic unexplained encounters. Since then, he has interviewed hundreds of witnesses and investigated a wide variety of paranormal phenomena. He is a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, a ghost hunter, a paranormal researcher, and the author of 26 books and more than 100 articles about UFOs and the paranormal. He lives in the San Fernando Valley near Los Angeles, California. Let's get on with the show. It's my great pleasure to be talking to today's guest, who is Preston Dennett. Preston, good to speak to you.
Hey, you too.
Let's start where I always like to start, which is, what first got you into investigating the paranormal, UFOs and the whole area? Was it some childhood incident or some early interest, or, you know, what triggered it?
Certainly was never anything I was interested in. Grew up pretty skeptical of all this. I did have one minor incident involving a precognition as a 9-year-old, but just kind of thought it was a fluke. Mm-hmm. and didn't think much of it. And yeah, I was very skeptical. I hated UFOs. I thought people who saw them were liars or on drugs, misperceiving, and just I felt sorry for them. So I was pretty cruel that way. But still a pretty young man. It was 1986. I'm like 21 years old.
Yep.
And I hear this report on the news. It's about a sighting over Alaska. It's now a very famous sighting, but the newscasters, they just kind of joked about it like they do on the news, or at least did back then. It's better now.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were talking about this amazing sighting by this commercial airline pilot. And I thought, wow, you know, this pilot is on drugs. You know, it's crazy. But it interested me because he was flying a jet. And I just couldn't believe that he would put his reputation on the line like that. And I started talking about it. It's just sort of an interesting topic of conversation among family and friends. And my brother's like, dude, I saw a UFO, remember? And I'm like, yeah, I do remember. And we all kind of just laughed at him and didn't even listen. So I'm like, all right, Mark, what did you see? And he described this amazing sighting. He was in his car with two friends who I knew, and they saw this metallic object close up, maybe 200 feet away, 50 feet high. And it had a dome, colored lights, your typical flying saucer. It was darting around. They saw other people looking at it. So they actually chased this thing for several miles down the road. Phil and Greg were there. You want to talk to them, they'll tell you the same thing. I said, all right, let me talk to Phil and Greg. And yeah, they were like, wow, man, I'm so glad you asked about this. No one believes me. And he described the same darn thing. I'm like, all right, not sure what's going on here. And my sister-in-law is like, you know, I saw one. I'm like, oh, no, really? It's like, yeah, over Van Nuys Air Force Reserve Base my two friends were there. You know, I still know Adlai. You can talk to him. And so I talked to him. And they saw this object right over an Air Force base. Bright lights. It hovered there for a long time, then quickly darted away. And I'm like, huh. So I started asking people and found out that a good 25, 30% of the people I knew, you know, family, friends, and coworkers, people I loved and trusted, were keeping secrets from me, big ones. I mean, I brought this up at work. I'm like, anyone see a UFO? And Diane, I'd worked with her for, five or 10 years. And a really nice, sweet lady. And she's like, oh, yeah, me and my whole family. We were in the San Bernardino Mountains, and this light was darting around. It stopped, it hovered, turn at right angles. And again, they had all these people had witnesses with them. So I'm like, wow. I started talking to the other witnesses. And in walks Dorothy. You know, I love Dorothy. She's very frank, very straightforward. And says, oh, UFOs? One chased me and my girlfriend and my mom home from the library. And I'm like, really? By this time, I had picked up a few books. And she's like, Preston, it's so weird because we live 5 minutes from the library. We left at 9 o'clock. When we got home, it was 10:15. I don't know what happened to the time. And I'm like, you know, I just picked up Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Missing Time is, of course, an abduction possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this hit home for me was, you know, as far as I was concerned, bad news. It was pretty upsetting. I felt scandalized. I'm like, they didn't teach this in schools. I mean, what is going on? So that's how it kind of all started. I joined MUFON, became an investigator, joined every UFO group, subscribed to all the magazines, started going to conventions, and eventually started interviewing people. Wrote an article for the local newspaper. To my shock, they put it on the front page. I'm like, whoa! And that was the first thing I ever wrote on this subject. And it just snowballed from there.
One thing I see here, just in the notes, you make a distinction between UFOs and USOs?
I think they're essentially the same thing, but at some point the term UFO doesn't really work, unidentified flying object, because I started getting reports of these objects coming in and out of the water.
Right.
I live here on the coast of California, and we have these objects come in and out of the water, so unidentified submersible object is a more accurate term,
right?
Floating around. So, yeah, I get a lot of those USOs.
I suppose for the skeptics, the first thought most people have, well, how do we know both UFOs and USOs that they're not military operations, given that the very nature of secret military research is you don't tell people what you're doing?
Right. Well, I can tell you I'm convinced it's not military for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting because this area where I'm at here in Southern California, the stretch of water between the Catalina Island and the mainland has an enormous amount of activity of USOs, probably one of the top 10 in the world. And I have to tell you, there's military in the area. There's Point Magoo Naval Base. The northern end, the southern end, there's Seal Beach Naval Weapons Station. So there is military. But the problem is this activity stretches back to at least the 1920s with modern reports of objects darting around. Beyond that, there's cases where these objects are hovering over people's homes. They're chasing cars down the highway. They're putting on massive displays for crowds of people. They're behaving in ways that's completely contrary to how the military does not do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's far too many of these sightings. There are some, in this particular area, there are some cases involving 50 objects, 100 objects, 200 objects. So if our military has that large number of secret military craft, I don't think they're going to be flying them around all at once in front of people.
Yep. That makes sense. That makes sense. Yes.
So, there are other reasons. You know, I've talked to a number of military people. Navy guys, submarine navigator, naval officers, another guy in a submarine. And they themselves are completely baffled by what we're seeing, what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say a good 10% of these cases, we have Air Force jets chasing after these objects, trying to intercept them vainly. You know, they're not able to do it. These objects kind of fly circles around us, literally. So that's another reason. I mean, because the military themselves are baffled by what they're seeing.
What about your own experiences with UFOs and USOs from going to interview other people's about their experiences? What have been your own experiences of them?
I never saw anything growing up. And I have to tell you, almost immediately after I started really digging into researching the subject, I did start having sightings because I wanted to see them. You know, I started going out at night, literally sleeping out at night, hoping to see a UFO. And probably the first time I saw anything unusual was after visiting a UFO group. There was a person speaking there who was a contactee, he said. And this is in downtown Santa Monica. And he said, after the meeting, I'll try and call down a UFO for anyone who wants to see one. I'm like, oh, that should be interesting.
Yes.
And so there was probably, you know, 50 people in that room, maybe more. It was a fairly well-visited UFO group. And after he spoke, it was now nighttime, and maybe 10, 20 people came out into the park there next to the building to see if he could do this. I thought, wow, you know, I thought everyone would want to see a UFO. That kind of surprised me. And he's like, all right, let's all get in a circle and hold hands and meditate. And my first thought was, oh, great. You know, this is kind of not what I signed up for. But I was open-minded enough to, you know, whatever. I'll do it. And we meditated for just a few minutes. Felt a little bit embarrassed because this is a public park, you know, where there's cars driving all around us on each side. And you can look up in the sky and there's not a single star. You can see the light pollution. I mean, there might have been a couple, but the light pollution was pretty fierce. I mean, you couldn't see anything of the night sky, just darkness. And he points to this section of the sky and says, look right there, they're coming. Look right there, don't look away. They're coming, and boom. I'd say it was about that long, 15 seconds maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And this very bright, it looked, I have to be honest, like a shooting star. But it came shooting down, and it was a big one. And right where he had pointed. And I thought, well, you know, the Perseids, it's not, you know, not the Leonids. It's not meteor shower this time. So I was impressed. I thought, wow, you know, it was kind of just ambiguous enough where I'm like, all right. But it was only, let's see, it was in 1992. I just really started digging in. And I was staying up late at night. I was talking to my sister-in-law, my brother, because they were kind of helping me through all this. I was pretty obsessed with the subject and discussing it deeply and investigating cases. And I'm driving home one evening around, you know, pretty late, 11, maybe midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in Woodland Hills, densely populated area. And coming around this little hairpin corner, maybe 2 miles an hour, very slow, just crawling. When I saw this, well, I thought it was a bird come swooping down towards my car. I instantly saw that it had no wings and it was actually a ball of light. This is late July. And I'm thinking, well, that's not a firework. And it comes swooping right in front of my car. Honest to God, 2 feet away, right in front of the windshield, over the hood of my car.
Yeah.
And it starts sweeping back and forth the full length of my windshield. So you can easily see this is not a reflection. And I'm like, oh my God. And this thing swept back and forth maybe 2-3 times, went forward, dipped down in front of my car, and then went shot straight up through the canopy of the trees and into, you know, outer space.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's got to be my closest sighting to date, but I've had a number since then, fairly regularly, actually. I was a little worried. I'm like, what's going on? Why am I seeing so many UFOs? And I started asking other researchers. And they're like, oh, yeah, it's called UFO investigator's disease. Didn't you know that? I'm like, what? Like, if you start studying them, they start studying you.
Right.
I'm like, oh, okay. And so I actually wrote about it, and I surveyed all these major researchers, and 80% have had some contact, sometimes extensive. And some say, no, I've never had anything, but I'm not sure I believe them. I think they might be just trying to, you know, remain objective.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've had some very good sightings.
Yeah. Is it your take that your part of the world, coastal area of California, is more prone to activity than, say, other parts of the US? Though obviously there are large empty spaces where nobody's around to see them anyway. But do you think that there's more activity in your particular area?
I'm going to say yes, with some qualifications, because like you said, California is the most populous state, and it has by far the most sightings in the United States. But New York is right there, and Texas, and they're runners-up. So it does seem to sort of be that where the people are is where people are seeing UFOs.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are certain areas in each state, pretty much, which seem, I don't want to say every state, but across the U.S., there are a number of really well-known hotspots. And certainly the Topanga Canyon area, Malibu, Santa Monica, and off the coast here is one of the major hotspots here in California.
Mm-hmm.
In Arizona, it's the Sedona area. In Colorado, it's the San Luis Valley. In New York, it's the Hudson Valley area, upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about these areas. And I've looked into it, you know, like Hudson Valley has a lot of mines. We know UFOs are interested in mines. There's lots of cases where they're hovering over them. So that could be a factor. And I know that Arizona is very rich in copper. And that could be a factor. So I'm not sure what's going on with these certain areas, maybe vortexes. People have told me that, which I'm not pleased with as an answer because it's not super scientific. You know, I'd like to be able to get my teeth into some hard data to say this is why.
Yeah, when people say a vortex, do you mean a sort of natural vortex of spiraling atmosphere or something like that? Or
yeah, electromagnetic energy.
Right.
Because we know, I mean, there is some science to this, actually. If you look, you know, we do have a magnetic field surrounding our planet, and some areas are more active than others.
Yeah.
So that could possibly be a factor. Honestly, I think we probably have, I know how this sounds to skeptics, I'm sorry, but I think we probably have bases here on our planet, UFO bases.
Right.
Say that because, you know, off the coast here, we have hundreds of objects coming out of the water. There's not a base. There's a parking lot down there. And I have to tell you, and another reason I didn't mention this, why we know it's not military, is because people are seeing ETs. They're seeing grays. You know, they're seeing praying mantids inside these things. And a number of people, particularly in this area off the coast, have been taken to not inside a UFO, you know, which is usually described as small, a round room, very clean, white or pastel colors. Instead, they're taken into what appears to be an underground area, very large, with, you know, stone-like walls in one case. So that's another reason why I think there are probably bases, at least perhaps in this area.
If we take it that there are bases, what do you think the ETs are doing there?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? We can only speculate. I'm guessing that, you know, they're there because they can hide easily.
Mm-hmm.
We can't get to them, and they still have access to a large population base, L.A., Los Angeles, because they do seem to be very interested in people. and physically examining them and learning about our emotions and all of this, I think we've actually got a pretty good handle on the ET agenda. Because when a person is taken on board, there are distinct patterns in terms of what they experience. And the most common thing is being physically examined. Sometimes people return with what appear to be foreign bodies, implants, not unusual. Sometimes injuries or even healings are described. People get messages, and they usually fall into three main categories. And I think this shows largely what the ET agenda is. Most primarily, people are given warnings about nuclear proliferation, pollution, overpopulation, global warming, this kind of thing. Our own warlike ways, that comes up periodically, our own prejudices. And they're warning us that, you know, we're going to destroy ourselves if we don't change. Which I think speaks very positively. Being physically examined, their genetic samples are taken, and people are often shown, and I cringe when I have to tell this to skeptics, hybrid babies, half alien, half human. And I know how that sounds, but they're coming from multiple independent sources who know nothing about each other. Pretty much all major UFO researchers, in terms of, you know, abductions and onboard encounters, have uncovered cases of this type. Bud Hopkins, you know, was the first to really bust this out into the mainstream. But I have to tell you, I started getting cases early on. One of my first involved this hybrid babies, and that was back in 89. Before, you know, Bud Hopkins had really put forth this theory, and I still get them regularly. So another agenda is people are taken to the engine room of these craft. It's really cool. You know, my latest book, I've got 15 accounts, and it's happened to at least four or five of them, where they're taken into the engine room, sat down in a chair and shown how to actually operate the craft or how it works, and told that it operates pretty much at some variation of electromagnetic energy. Magnetics. So that I think is interesting. And they're always, ETs are always saying, you know, you don't need fossil fuels. There are other sources of energy that are non-polluting. So there seems to be a push towards that. And thirdly, and this is pretty strong, people are given messages that have something to do with spirituality in kind of a wide umbrella, from everything from hands-on healing, Reiki, to astral travel, past lives, channeling, psychic stuff, and people come away from their experiences. This is almost universal, spiritually transformed. They have a completely new viewpoint of life. They are have a lot of psychic experiences, pretty much across the board. So that's definitely a factor, and I think what the ETs are doing is trying to wake us up to our own human potential, because we can do these things. We are able to do telepathy. Telepathy has been proven in a laboratory setting, as has levitation, by the way. And a lot of these so-called paranormal things are not paranormal at all. It's just our lack of understanding of how, you know, the mechanics behind it work. They're trying to wake us up to that. So I'm very hopeful how all this rolls out in the end. One thing that does concern me is the abduction phenomena in and of itself. Kidnapping someone is illegal. You know, you're not allowed to do that. And supposedly, you know, there are some people who say, oh, you know, people have given permission, perhaps on a subconscious level or even a pre-life agreement, which doesn't really hold water. Overall, you know, I always ask people who have had this experience, do you think, you know, this is evil? Was this bad? You know, what is your take on this? And most say, oh, no, I don't think they're evil. Very rarely do I hear that. But a lot don't say they're super friendly either.
Yeah.
You know, overall, it's definitely skewed towards being more friendly. And the reason I say that is because when people are taken on board, what we don't hear, you know, because normally when someone's kidnapped, it's bad news. You know, they're going to be tortured, raped, killed. That's not what the ETs are doing at all. Their agenda is not to scare people, not to hurt people. They're not sadistic. I have no evidence of that really at all. They're not trying. They're not trying to hurt people.
Yeah.
So ultimately, their behavior is more benevolent than human.
You're listening to the Weird Tales Radio Show with Charles Christian.
Have you, from accounts, people you've talked to, got any idea of where these aliens have come from? Because, I mean, one of the arguments always made from a skeptical point of view is that given what we know of the solar system we live in, they must have come a long way to get here and have fairly advanced, possibly faster than light type travel or something like that. Any ideas or any suggestions where they are coming from and why they are coming down to Earth?
It's curious, isn't it? I mean, what's so special about us, for one thing?
Yeah.
Why are we seeing so many different types? And aren't the stars too far away? I mean, we know that we certainly can't do it. However, we're kind of stuck with these reports. They're coming from somewhere. There's been a lot of speculation about it. You know, the Betty and Barney Hill case was a very early abduction case, and the ETs flat out said we're from Zeta Reticula, or at least implied it with the map and all that. And I have to tell you, there's a number of cases that has been confirmed, particularly with the Grays, but they're few and far between. And there's cases here and there where ETs kind of mention, oh, we're from Andromeda, we're from Arcturus, Orion, the Pleiades. But again, these are sort of scattered cases because in most, they don't say. And I have to tell you, my own research, I've really looked into this, and there's been some very interesting things that have happened. One lady I interviewed, Melinda Leslie, that she asked them, and they told her, oh, it's not important. It's not important. Another person was told, oh, you wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. Another said, it's from a place you don't know about yet. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, that doesn't tell us anything. So they're very coy about their answers. And I think because our military, by all reports, has this technology and are flying these UFOs around, possibly to other star systems. And being the violent race that we are, they don't want to reveal their locations. That's one speculation. Now, people say, oh, maybe they're interdimensional. Maybe they're time travelers. You know, I can't really speak to that. We ourselves are interdimensional as human beings. I mean, we have a soul. We're all going to die and go to the other side. So we have our own interdimensional aspect, and I expect all biological beings do. So that doesn't really satisfy me as an answer, saying that ETs are interdimensional, other than the possibility that they have, you know, being more advanced than us, judging from their craft, have learned how to travel through dimensions. And certainly this would explain, you know, how they're able to travel vast distances between the stars. And it's very interesting, because there are a number of cases where people have described what these ETs doing is essentially stopping time. And like one case, I'll just give an example. This is from one of my books. Man I interviewed up in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, had an experience where his whole family was seeing UFOs fairly regularly. Most of the activities centered around him. Ever since a young child, he's had experiences. He had a missing time encounter. But one time he's out there on the farm. This is outside in a pretty rural area. And everyone starts screaming, there's a UFO, there's a UFO. And he looks up, and sure enough, there's this classic metallic disc flying around, and the whole family's freaking out. He runs inside to get his shotgun, not to shoot this thing, but because it's got a scope, you know, like a telescope.
Yeah.
And he wants to see this thing up close. So he runs back outside and he sees the object and he lifts up the scope and he looks at the sky and he can't find it. He's like, wow, that's weird. And he searches around, pulls the scope down and looks around him in complete shock because his family is now completely frozen. They're not moving. Neither are the birds in the sky or the leaves on the trees. Everything's completely stopped, as if time is completely stopped, except not for him. So it's very disorienting and extremely frightening for him. And he's looking around for this UFO and he sees it's landed on his driveway, the end of the driveway, which is a pretty big driveway. And three grays are coming out and coming towards him very quickly, kind of gliding. And that's when he blacks out. But yeah, they appeared to stop time. And I have one, two, three, four, five cases at least recently, just like that. Just like that. Same thing.
And you mentioned earlier on about missing time. This is the kind of thing where people think it may only be minutes, but they discover it's hours have gone by since they've had their encounter. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is something researchers have known early on. Certainly before I came into the field, it had been discovered that if a person has a close-up sighting as missing time, it very likely might mean that they've been taken on board.
Mm-hmm.
And probably does mean that. And it was a very hard lesson for me to learn because I'd be interviewing these people. And it took me a year of interviewing them, at least before I realized that if a UFO is within a couple of hundred feet, there's a very high probability of missing time.
Mm-hmm.
And you might not know it. Like a good case, I was interviewing this guy, Mark Grant, and his friend had seen a UFO very close up. And I thought, they said it was very frightening. And they ended up fleeing the area. And it never even occurred to me to ask him if they had missing time because, you know, he didn't mention it. But after going over his interview, I'm like, I think they did because they started showing all the markers. There was a very close up sighting. First, this object was in one place and they're looking at it. Next thing they know, there's a shift as if they had lost consciousness or became disoriented, is what they said. And this object was much closer. It was swooping away from them now. And they had a very, very strong emotional reaction of fear, another red flag.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't able to confirm whether or not for sure because he didn't know the time. But yeah, I think missing time probably very common with close-up sightings, more so than maybe even UFO investigators believe.
Mm-hmm.
But some people remember. They remember fully consciously. In my latest book, Onboard Encounters, only one person used hypnosis. The rest, I mean, they had missing time, but they also had fully conscious encounters where they were taken on board.
When you say only one person had hypnosis, it seems that they were hypnotized or hypnotism was used to try and recover what happened during that period.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have explained that a little better. Regressive hypnosis is an effective tool used to recover memories.
Right, that's
and
right.
And it has been used.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been used in cases of like war victims.
Yes.
Who have had PTSD.
Yes.
It's been used effectively with by the police to sort of get more information from eyewitnesses, child abuse victims who can't remember. And so UFO investigators started using it, and it definitely works. We know it works because these accounts that are coming out under hypnosis match perfectly. They dovetail perfectly with fully conscious eyewitness encounters.
Right, right.
So it's a very effective tool. I normally don't recommend it unless a person is having anxieties or they are just dead set on knowing, you know, what happened during a very clear-cut case of missing time. Because I've had people who've gone under hypnosis and were not entirely satisfied. And because what you're going to get is a a memory recalled through hypnosis. It's going to be slightly different than a real memory. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be that little bit of doubt in there. And people can recall this through extensive questioning, through meditation, through just going over and over the incident and pulling details out of your subconscious bit by bit. That's almost as effective sometimes.
And you also mentioned people seeing different types of aliens. You mentioned the Greys, which I think is probably nowadays the most popular, most frequently cited example of an alien. What other ones are people seeing then?
Yeah, it's absolutely, in my own research, and I think this bears out in other people's, mostly Greys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say 50, 60, 70%. When I say Greys, there's various types. They're pretty well known in the media, but short, bald, large head, large dark eyes, and very diminutive features.
Yeah.
Ranging from 3 feet tall and very much like automatons and emotionless to sort of 5 foot tall, 4 to 5 feet tall even, sometimes emotional. You get kind of this whole range. I'm thinking there's different types of Greys, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of what kept me out of UFO research. I remember stumbling across it now and then, like on In Search Of, that program, and others.
Yeah.
Where they'd talk about people seeing ETs. I'm like, well, what? They have arms and legs and eyes, nose, and mouth? I don't believe that for a second. And what we're stuck with is universally humanoids mm-hmm. being reported. So Greys mostly. After that, I'm going to say sort of a tie between praying mantis type, like giant grasshoppers or praying mantis, bug-like, mm-hmm.
yeah.
insectoid, which is fairly common. And they are usually described as 6 to 9 feet tall. But I have some outliers of up to 15 feet tall. So very big, with eyes the size of basketballs, is how one guy described it. Mm-hmm. He's a Navy medic, by the way, a great witness. So praying mantis, and beyond that would be human looking, just like us, though perhaps a little better looking. they're usually described as being very handsome. Very beautiful people, muscular, well put together, different races, by the way. Sometimes people call them Nordic, but it's not an accurate term because we've got light-skinned, we've got dark-skinned, Mesoamerican looking beings, 5 feet tall to 6 feet tall, 6.5, usually very muscular. Another thing we hear, which is very strange, is that they often look when they're seen in groups, very similar, almost like twins. So we have a group of human-looking ETs, and they'll all look like brothers,
mm-hmm.
or identical even. Handsome, genetically perfect is terms I hear several times. So they're often described as very good-looking, genetically perfect, but there's this weird catch-all category. There's reptilians as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very small category. I've only gotten a handful of those reports out of, literally the hundreds of others. And reptilians are usually not seen in association with the UFO, by the way. It's just wandering out there in the wilderness, usually. Like the Everglades is where I've gotten one report.
Right, yeah.
Or sometimes entering people's homes. And the speculation is that they live on our planet. Don't know if that's true. Like I said, we don't really know where these guys are from.
Yeah.
But this one catch-all category of strange humanoids, I guess you'd call it. And that can be anything from little dwarfs, hairy or perhaps not, very tall beings, light beings, robotic-like beings, just weird, unique entities that I've never heard before or since.
Do you think some of these are actually beings that live on this planet and just keep away from humans, but they've been around a long time. You know, when you start going back into folklore, you quickly come into the fae, the fairies, and various creatures like that. That it was 1,500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, accepted that there were these strange little creatures that lived with us, but sort of kept themselves secret and did their own things. Do you think that there's an element of overlap with that?
It's one of the curious things about this phenomenon is I looked into fairies, absolutely. And I was really shocked by how much evidence there was and how credible it was. There are a number of researchers who have flat out rejected the extraterrestrial theory and say that this is a phenomena that's been on Earth for a very long time and is wearing different masks. And they start pointing to these various historical phenomena. But looking into it, I'm not convinced. I think there's some great evidence for angels. I'm not convinced they're necessarily aliens.
Yeah,
I think there's some very good evidence for, demonic poltergeists and, poltergeists and demonic spirits and ghosts of all kinds. And I don't think those are aliens either. Because there's what we're seeing now, there's really no historical precedent for. We don't have ever in anything historical that I can find very large numbers of people being claiming to have been taken on board by bug-eyed creatures.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not there.
Yeah.
So I don't think that aliens necessarily come from here. I'm not going to rule it out because we don't know. One lady I did talk to, the ETs told her, we come from a binary star system. They didn't name it, but they showed her these little bronze-like disks, which sort of had this representation of their twin star system is what they called it, not a binary star. And they said that we come from the fourth planet on the second star. And another guy asked them where they're from, and he said the room suddenly became like a 3D star chart, and he could see our solar system, Earth, and way, way, way off in the distance, this red light was blinking, and they said, that's our system, and they named it. And he says, don't ask me to pronounce it. It was too long, and it had all these syllables, and I don't remember, but they did name it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, because if we have crashed UFOs in our possession, the military, and I think we do, because there are accounts of Roswell UFO crash in 1947,
mm-hmm.
Is not the only one. There was another at the same time in New Mexico. There was the Aztec crash in New Mexico, the Paradise Valley crash in Arizona, the Kecksburg crash in Pennsylvania. I wrote a UFO history for a number of states. They all had UFO crashes. I know there's reports all across the world. So we have this hardware. And if we have these bodies and we have these craft, all bets are off. We kind of know what we're dealing with.
Hmm.
These are extraterrestrials from other planets, like us, but different. And I think it's the theory which best fits the evidence. I really do.
Hmm.
I'm not going to rule out, other types of beings, because perhaps fairies were real. I think they probably were. And maybe some of them were misinterpreted. I don't know. That's not my area of expertise, honestly. It varies, but I certainly looked into it because there's some very intriguing correlations for sure.
And on timelines, most of the reports, and if you like, the first UFO scares, panics or whatever, really are post the Second World War through to the modern times. But you mentioned a case you found as long ago as the 1920s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you look into this phenomena, you will see that we've got reports stretching back thousands of years. And we know this from all kinds of historical documents, from hieroglyphics, from cave paintings, from petroglyphs, from Renaissance art, from art in the Middle Ages, from wood carving. From actual, historical documents, like the Romans, we've got reports. They called them flying shields. They didn't know what they were. But the idea of them being extraterrestrials wasn't really popularized until, 1800s, perhaps, when science fiction brought up the idea of aliens. So we've had a lot of reports stretching back, and they go right up through the 1800s, you know, 1700s, 1800s. We're starting to get some more solid reports. 1900s, yeah, we've got ones all throughout the whole turn of the century there. There was a huge airship wave. So, but yes, something happened in 1947, and researchers pinpointed it pretty quickly, because in 47 we had a massive super wave sweeping across the world. Very large numbers of sightings, and it hasn't really stopped since. This is what I mean by historically unprecedented.
Yes,
there's waves of sightings before throughout history, but not constant. So number of researchers have brought up the remarkable coincidence that the atomic age coincides exactly, right, with the modern age of UFOs, 1947. This is when we started really experimenting a lot with atomic weapons. So I think, you know, that's been actually verified in, to some respect, by experiencers, people who've been taken on board and been told, you know, like I said earlier, being warned about nuclear testing. So apparently our testing in this area is causing problems in far-reaching areas. This is what the experiencers are being told. Don't know if it's true. But yeah, I think that it's different now than it's ever been. We've got much larger number of sightings, and it's still escalating. You know, we've heard of MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, and NUFORC, National UFO Reporting Center. Those are the two main reporting centers here in the U.S., and they get multiple reports daily. We're talking 10, 20 a day, at least. And I have to say, that's vastly underestimating the actual number of sightings, because most people don't report. One in 10, maybe. Actually, it's closer to 1 in 100, but let's just say it's 1 in 10, which would put, you know, the number of sightings per day at 200. Could be 2,000. I think it's probably closer to 2,000 than 200, honestly. But either way, that's a lot. And that means that someone right now is seeing a UFO this very second. Just statistically speaking, there's that many reports. And that makes sense, because this is an ongoing phenomena. And both these reporting centers are getting more and more reports each year. Now, whether that's because people are more aware of this phenomena and are more likely to report it, or whether the phenomena itself is actually escalating, I don't know, but I'm thinking the latter, because there's these continuing waves of sightings. You know, these things come very low and they show themselves over, like, the Phoenix Lights, or the Hudson Valley wave, or the Gulf Breeze wave. There was a huge wave over Belgium. France had a giant wave in the 1950s that's really unprecedented. I mean, they were having landings daily, flyovers for a good year. Well, a good, that summer of 1954 was crazy. So they're clearly on some sort of campaign to announce their presence. Normally they're very evasive, but they also have this sort of brazen in-your-face behavior that says, look at us.
You've written a number of books. I've got some of them here. Out of Body Exploring, A Beginner's Approach, Schoolyard UFO Counters, Undersea UFO Base and Onboard UFO Encounters. But I see you've also written about the ghosts of Greater Los Angeles, and along with UFOs and ETs, you've also got an interest in ghosts as well, haven't you?
Yeah, and I'm ashamed to admit it, Bigfoot as well, which I didn't want to get into because I knew I was opening up a can of worms. But I started getting these cases. And it's really weird because, you know, I started with UFOs. But one time I'm interviewing this lady who'd seen a UFO know, her friend saw it. It was this egg-shaped object, came right over their house, made a low buzzing noise, very quiet, and then moved off. She says, you know, I also have a ghost. I'm like, oh, really? You know, Sylvia was her name. She's, you know, a pilot. She's a scuba diver. She's, you know, a very good witness and described this ghostly activity that was going on in her house. I'm like, wow, all right. And so I started, you know, asking people and found out that the ghosts were real and had to buy all the ghost books. I'm like, shoot. And I get these really weird cases where people were having all kinds of activity. How I got involved in Bigfoot was I talked to this guy who had a UFO land in his backyard. This is in Canyon Country, California, a very rural area. He's a radiologist. He said it was just blue and white lights, but it was right there on the ground. I don't know what it could have been. And it took off. And he said, here's where it gets weird. This is the next night I had a Bigfoot encounter, and it was in the same darn place. He could hear this thing screaming. His dogs were going crazy. He felt like it was reading his mind. And I'm like, telepathy, oh, great, you know. hadn't really looked into Bigfoot. So I'm like, all right. Kind of got dragged into it, kicking and screaming, and found out it was real for sure. The evidence is mountainous. It's conclusive. There's no doubt it's a real phenomena. And there's this weird intersection between UFOs and Bigfoot in a very, very tiny minority, 1% less, of cases. Most Bigfoot cases don't involve UFOs. Most UFO cases don't involve Bigfoot. But in this 1%, they intersect perfectly, where people are seeing UFOs and Bigfoot at literally in the same time. This case, it was like the day after. But then he had a poltergeist outbreak in the weeks that followed, a really bad one. His whole family was like going crazy with it. So there's a connection there. I mean, I had another case where I was investigating this haunted apartment in Van Nuys, California. And it was really bad. I mean, these girls were having a real problem. They ended up moving out because of knocking noises, cold spots, apparitions that would come running in into their bodies and try to possess them. Went all the way to, yeah, near possession. I interviewed their next door neighbor who was having problems. Finally, I called up the manager, and the manager's like, oh my God, so glad you called, and started just describing all these experiences going on throughout the building. Major haunting there. And these two ladies described one incident where they were in the apartment and they started to hear this loud buzzing noise, and it got louder and louder and louder. And finally they ran out in their balcony and this giant UFO is hovering over the apartment. And it's got little lights on it. It's U-shaped. It's very low. It's not a helicopter. And they feel like it's looking at them and is aware of them. And it scares them pretty bad because they're thinking, you know, what has this got to do with this haunting, which they're going, you know, through at the same time. It was, you know, not long after that they moved out. They had lots of witnesses, by the way. They'd bring people over and they saw stuff too. Yeah, there's a weird connection there. I can't quite figure it out.
Turning to the future, what current projects are you working on at the moment, and what are you looking to be doing in the near future?
Right now, sort of advertising and publicizing my latest book, Onboard UFO Encounters, working on another one about UFOs that visit drive-in theaters. So weird. I found this case where a UFO came swooping down over a drive-in and scared the living daylights out of the audience and remembered another and at least one more. And I thought, oh, this will be kind of fun, breezy investigation. Instead, I found nearly 100 cases. This is kind of exactly what happened when I looked into schoolyards being visited by UFOs. So yeah, there's a weird connection there. And so that's my next project I'm working on right now. Got more in line after that. Keeping busy. And yeah, I love investigating this stuff. I think UFOs are an important subject. I think they have the potential to change the world. Mm. That's something I take very seriously.
If people want to contact you about their sightings or experiences, what's the best way? Your website, prestondennett.weebly.com?
Oh, yeah, that would be perfect. You can contact me through my website, and I've got multiple ways to contact me through there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would love to hear from people, whether they've got a story to share or a question or a comment. And all my books are there if you want to read excerpts. And you can purchase them through my website or through Amazon and other online retailers. And I love the subject. I'm super passionate about it.
I can tell. Great enthusiasm coming across the, airwaves. It's not quite because we're on Skype, but great enthusiasm you've got there. Well, Preston, that's been brilliant talking to you. And thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much for the opportunity and had a lot of fun.
And that's it. We're totally out of time. Once again, a big thank you to our guest, Preston Dennett. You can find him, along with excerpts from his many books, at www.prestondennett.weebly.com. And Preston Dennett, it's a double N in the Dennett part and a double T. Next week, we're heading in an entirely different direction, exploring a little bit of pop culture as we talk to Dan Hill about decoding the faces of famous people. Movie, music and TV stars, and even politicians. They may look happy, shiny people on the silver screen, but inside they are scared, resentful, angry, or just plain crazy. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying, until the next time we're together, stay well, stay weird, stay different.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. You can keep in touch with us online at www.weirdtalesradio.com. By email to weirdtales@icloud.com and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.